Well, Dr. Morgan, these sounds that we've just been listening to are very suggestive to space cadets, I expect. Do you think we ought to take a negative stand and make a very positive statement of what they're not? That they're not sounds of flying saucers?
Yes, I think we can be quite sure about that.
Dr. Morgan, what is the difference, the distinction? Let's go at this backwards. And a whistler.
Well, a swish. It might be called a broad band of noise, which descends through the audio frequency spectrum with time. Whereas a whistler is more coherent, and as the name suggests, produces a descending whistle rather than a swishing tone.
In other words, the whistler is a rarefied and specialized case of the swish.
We find some which start out like a swish and end up like a whistler, and we call these swishlers.
Does the reverse ever hold true?
No, I don't.
In other words, the whish. Does the whish?
I don't recall any whishes, but we might listen for these. There are some preceded by a rising whistle and a decreasing swish. Then there are also some swishlers followed by sort of wavering whistles on the end, which wander up and down a bit in frequency and are rather pure whistles.
They're audio frequencies, but they're not audible unless you have radio ears.
That's correct. They're audio frequency radio waves. And you need first to amplify them and then to apply the electrical signal to a transducer so that it is a sonic wave that you can hear.
We've talked about whistlers a lot. Now perhaps we should just devote no more than a minute or two to the tweak.
The tweak is rather well understood. If a lightning flash is 1,500 miles away, the ground wave propagation from it is rather weak. The signal is propagated by reflection from the residual ionosphere at night. The first impulse that you get from a distance of 1,500 miles would be a single reflection from the ionosphere. It's also possible for the signal to make one reflection from the ground at the midpoint and two from the ionosphere, and we call this a two-hop path. It's also possible to make three hops and four and so forth. Well, one finds that the arrival time of the pulses is such that the successive pulses are spaced apart by increasing amounts, but that they approach a constant separation, so that this series of pulses spaced a little further apart from one to the next corresponds to a short, rapidly decreasing tone. Tweak seems to be the best word to describe them. It's possible to take many of the little poppings you hear, which are not crashes and not tweaks, slow down the playback speed after recording them, and demonstrate that these are indeed tweaks, but that the rate of decline of the tone is so fast that they're not recognizable as well-developed tweaks until you slow them down.
A mature tweak is one that's many miles away.
If the discharge is close to you, it is a crash or a bonk, and if it's far enough away so that it's not that but not a tweak, it's one of these little popping noises, which can be shown to be a immature tweak.
What about the dawn chorus?
Well, the dawn chorus, on the other hand, is not at all well understood, and there is no theory to explain it. It's known to correlate in a rough sort of way with occurrence of the aurora and magnetic storms. We are eagerly looking forward to a chance to observe visible aurora and listen to the dawn chorus and see if the dynamic behavior of the two phenomena correlate in any obvious way as you observe them simultaneously. This is certainly in the realm of conjecture at this point, and simultaneous observations of the dawn chorus and the visible aurora might give some clues as to whether this is a possibility at all.
Well, Dr. Morgan, let's get back to the subject of whistlers again. Let's listen again to a whistler, and maybe this time to one that bounced back and forth, not just once, but five or six times between the northern and southern hemispheres. Manifestation takes place as a result of some rude and abrupt electrical shock, such as a bolt of lightning taking place.
That's right. After all, the excitation of the ionosphere by a bolt of lightning is pretty much like hitting the ionosphere with a hammer, exciting it across the full frequency spectrum. You can hear lightning crashes on the very high frequencies and in the usual communication frequencies in the broadcast band at low frequencies where aircraft warning beacons operate, and even at audio frequencies such as these, which produce the swishers or whistlers.
I've only been exposed to this situation now for a short time, and it's hard to dig in and find some way to relate it to something we know about. Let me try this out as a metaphor on you. Let's compare the lightning stroke to a deck of cards. Perhaps there are more than 52 cards in it, but there is a deck of cards before us, which is in its original shape and piled all one on top of the other, it becomes a lightning bolt. But Fourier told us some years ago that any such phenomenon is composed of a large number of individual frequencies or pitches, tones. Rolled up into one ball of wax and occurring simultaneously, which will add up into this one particular lightning bolt. Could we say that in the process of transmitting this deck of cards from the northern to the southern hemisphere and back, that the cards get strung out all the way from the deuce of clubs to the ace of spades, the deuce of clubs being the lowest frequency, comes back to the last in order?
Yes, that's a perfectly satisfactory representation of the phenomenon, I think. If each card travels with a little different velocity than its neighbor, then the deck would be smeared out in the process of the trip.
Now, the reason for all this taking place, and it's hard for us to imagine a sudden impact like a lightning bolt stringing out over such a long period of time, as I understand it, is they're traveling way out beyond a diameter of the Earth down to the southern hemisphere and back.
This idea of hemisphere bouncing is a great concept on the grand scale. It seems to me it dwarfs the concepts of even geopolitics. Whose idea was it in the first place?
Well, this is the theory which was propounded by L.R.O. Story at Cambridge University in 1951. Whistlers were discovered by Barkhausen, and Eckersley at Marconi's wireless company did quite a bit of work with them. And he, Eckersley, suggested a dispersive path, a long path, over which the velocity of propagation depended upon the frequency of the wave. He left it at that. Story made the suggestion that the long path was the Earth's magnetic field, and showed how a certain mode of propagation in the ionosphere is guided along Earth magnetic field lines and could account for propagation from one hemisphere into the other along these long paths. Story's theory has not been verified in its one of its most important details, that is, to find out if whistlers are observed simultaneously at each end of an Earth's magnetic field line. They should also be observable in the southern hemisphere at the point of reflection. This is a very critical experiment that has yet to be performed.
I take it that you are doing that now, or making the arrangements for it.
That's right. There are relatively few places on the Earth's surface where you can reach opposite ends of a flux line and be land and be at middle latitude, so that the flux line is of a length over which whistlers are known to occur. The path that we are working on is between the Aleutians and the South Island of New Zealand. Another path over which measurements are being planned is between Bermuda and the Falkland Islands. The length of the African continent is a further possibility, but the latitude is so low that it's not known whether any whistlers can be heard.
And eventually, I suppose, someone will establish an Antarctic or Arctic observation point.
Yes, we will be observing at about 65 degrees north magnetic latitude in Labrador shortly. And if the results are productive, the natural desire after that will be to go to still higher latitudes. Magnetic flux lines increase in length very rapidly as the latitude increases. This means that the propagation path goes to much greater distances above the Earth's surface. We don't know whether the required density is always there or only sometimes there. A question as to whether there will be enough particle density to support the propagation. The 400 electrons per cubic centimeter called for by Story's analysis of the situation for his path is the hardest part of his theory to accept. Only recently, measurements on the scattering of sunlight into the dark side of the Earth have suggested that there is indeed a particle density of about 400 electrons per cubic centimeter at such a height as an Earth diameter above the surface.
What latitude does that correspond to? What flux line is at that elevation?
The latitude of Cambridge or Dartmouth. 55 degrees. The suggestion has been made that the particle density of 400 electrons per cc may be provided by an extension of the solar corona or the solar atmosphere as far away from the sun as our distance at 93 million miles. If this is true, then, of course, the same density would exist further away from the Earth, and the possibility of Whistler's being propagated from higher latitudes and over flux lines which extend further out from the Earth exists. Whether it continues to fall off or whether it actually starts to rise again as one gets further out from the Earth but closer to the sun.
Would you even care to say that there might be some question as to whether at that point it is the atmosphere of the Earth or the atmosphere of the sun?
If the suggestion that we are immersed in the atmosphere of the sun is valid, someplace there must be a crossover, and they become indistinguishable.
In other words, you might even, let's say possibly, find a null point where no transmission was found, yet beyond which it was again reestablished as you went farther north magnetically.
Yes, this would be possible.
That would be an exciting discovery.
Yes, it certainly would.